You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing.
Hello, today we're going to be talking about racism in the food industry. My name is Tahia.
My name is Tamwani.
My name is Peyton.
All right, to kind of start off, we wanted to kind of talk about our experiences. Kind of growing up, my experience as a person of color with food growing up, I often remember kind of going to school when I started. I remember when we like immigrated here, my like parents would pack me my lunch, a braai, curry, and I remember kind of taking it to school, and I learned very quickly within like the first 2-3 weeks that like my food was very different from what like other girls and people were bringing to school. I remember because I used to go to a school that was primarily white, being made fun of for my food a lot. Because, people saying things like, it's smelly, or like, what is that? When, they had like cat balls or like macaroni and cheese. And I remember just, it's not a good feeling when you're a little kid and just being really ashamed of my food. And I remember coming home and telling my parents, I don't want any of my home food. I only want you to pack me like sandwiches or like cat balls, tomato soup. That's the only thing I want, that's the only thing I want to take to work or to school. And I didn't really tell my parents anything about why, just because it was embarrassing. And then now that I'm a little bit older now, the whole trend of like, with people going out for Indian food or like curry, it's become very like normalized, or it's become very like trendy. And sometimes that can be really hurtful to kind of see how it's a trend now, things that like you were made fun of when you were little. Do any of you guys have any similar experiences?
No, I would say, because I wasn't raised in Canada, I grew up in Malawi, which is in Africa, so I didn't have that similar experience, but I definitely do see that. Not as it reminds me of the conversation we were having last week about how things from different cultures are kind of seen as negative when we're younger, and then when we're older, you see it kind of reflected more in white media, and that's when it becomes like more attractive. And I definitely do see that with white people kind of like embracing, Asian cuisines and, cuisines from different cultures, when before maybe they were part of the issue of like bullying the, the people who are coming with that authentic food to start off with. So yeah, that's my experience.
Exactly. I think it kind of speaks to the whole, like you mentioned, like gentrification of food, where any food that's not maybe like part of the white kind of culture, white food, you immediately label it as like ethnic food. And that just kind of speaks to how there is a dominant culture, right? In this case, it being white culture and white food. And so anything that doesn't fit into that category is immediately labeled as like ethnic, or it's like non-local. It's not just food that people, that live in that country eat. So it is very like divisive, and it's like very, it like creates separation. And like, yeah, I think there's some, it is immediately labeled as like ethnic, which is not good.
Yeah, I think, obviously I don't have any like personal experiences with this being a white person, but that is definitely something that I noticed when I was like learning more about this issue, particularly when I was learning about like the food industry and food media in particular. It seems like there's a huge issue when it comes to sort of commodifying these like so-called like ethnic foods or whatever, and they usually end up being highlighted by white people in order to make it more palatable to a white audience, which I think, especially like coming from what you guys said, would be extremely frustrating considering the like roots in which those dishes are made fun of, seen as like gross or smelly or weird. It really seems like it would be a hugely frustrating issue.
Yeah, definitely.
This also reminds me of a situation that happened, I think, a couple of years, well, maybe not a couple of years back, I think. Well, I'm not sure when exactly, but the kind of food media or network that's widely known as like Bon Appetit, which is like a really popular YouTube channel as well. I used to like love their watching their videos. And if you like food, you probably came across their content as well. And they came under fire, at least their editor in chief of their like magazine or print media, because he was kind of dressed in brownface as like a Puerto Rican. But at the same time, he had one of the like food writers who wanted to write a column about Puerto Rican food. And he kind of denied their, you know, their pitch. But it was kind of hypocritical because here's a guy who for Halloween saw it appropriate to kind of dress up as a Puerto Rican and, you know, wear a do-rag, like paint, you know, tan his face and all these things. But at the same time, he didn't want to like highlight that food by a genuine and authentic like Puerto Rican person who knows the history and the culture of it. So it's kind of different from what we're saying of like how, you know, when things are, you know, taken by white people, it's more palatable. That just takes it to a different extent of this, like, also just like seeing again, like, why is that food not good enough to be highlighted? But it's, you know, it's just there to be made fun of. These people are, you know, you don't want to highlight the good aspects of their culture, but it's appropriate to kind of dress up and make a costume of their culture. It's not great.
Yeah, no, it's very not good. I think it just kind of speaks to how some of your, like, if you just kind of look at maybe history, there are definitely some cuisines that were, you know, just great. Speaking of like, you know, Great Britain and like Europe, there were certain cuisines that were kind of just immediately labeled as like, you know, fine dining or higher class, right? So we don't see a lot of all you can eat French buffets. You don't see a lot of all you can eat Italian buffets, right? They're very, French restaurants are very expensive. Italian restaurants are very high end. You have to like dress a certain way to go sit there. It's hard to kind of get in, actually, right? But then there's tons of people out there who cannot even fathom paying like more than buffet prices for like an Indian restaurant, right? It's meant to be almost fast. It's not fast food. It's a proper restaurant, but it's meant to be, or it's perceived as like being almost like fast food, right? People expect to pay very cheap prices for Indian restaurants, right?
Yeah, I think that goes for like a lot of different types of food, like Chinese food as well. Like you very, mm-hmm. very rarely see like high-end Chinese or maybe Japanese is more common, not particularly where I live in Edmonton for sure. They're few and far between. And I think it definitely just makes you question, it's like, okay, who decided what gets to be high-end and what gets to be like the affordable, cost-friendly option? Like once you start looking at it that way, I think it becomes very obvious which types of food get the privilege of being viewed that way and which don't.
Yeah, and I think this also like undercuts the people of color who are trying to, you know, get into the restaurant industry, and they're seeing that, you know, customers are not willing to pay the price for, you know, the food and the actual, like, it's well seasoned, it tastes better, but you're not like willing to pay the price that you would pay because something isn't European. So yeah, that's kind of sad to see. But another thing that I wanted to really touch base with is, you know, as somebody who I've recently been trying to eat a little bit more plant-based, just for, you know, health reasons and also like for the environment, there's many benefits to it. And I kind of have seen a pattern of like this whitewashing of vegetarianism and also like veganism. You don't really see, you know, just for context, I am Black. You don't really see a huge representation of Black people or just people of color in general who follow a plant-based lifestyle or, you know, follow a vegan or vegetarian diet. It's typically just like very whitewashed. It feels like predominantly like wealthy white, you know, women who are like, you know, very skinny and all of those things. But I was actually surprised to find that when I was doing research for this podcast, that there's actually a higher growing population of Black people, this is US data, but like Black people who are following a vegan diet in comparison to white people. But for some reason, this isn't like reflected in the media and like in the representation. And yeah, it's seen as very much like a white thing to do. If you go vegan or vegetarian, it's seen as very much a white thing to do. When surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, if you think about it, the highest population of vegetarians, and I looked this up as well, is in India. And so the most, if you want the most like vegetarian food, it's a lot of like Indian and like Asian cuisines that are naturally just plant-based. But for some reason, when you think of plant-based diets, you think of white people. So I find that like very interesting. And I don't know what your guys' thoughts on them.
Yeah, I do think that that's really interesting because you're right. When I think of veganism, like I think it does have a very like strong association with whiteness. And I guess that again comes down to like the way in which like the way in which we decide like what stuff is shown as trendy. Cause I think when I'm thinking veganism, I'm thinking like Whole Foods-esque type, like those like corporations that sort of like decide that certain foods and certain lifestyles are a trend. When really a lot of these like eating styles, like you said, like a lot of the roots are in India, I'm sure for a variety of reasons, but that's not what is like marketed towards you, I don't think.
Yeah, and like you bring up the point about in like for cultural reasons, even like religious reasons, they have been vegetarians for long, long time. And I think it's exactly like you were saying, Peyton, it's just a trend. I think there's a lot of power. And while I do think like eating plant-based, it's very good for the environment, it's very good for you, it's very healthy. And while maybe there is, you know, it's good that it's becoming this popular, it definitely, it's become very trendy in the last years when it's something that's been done for a long, long time. And yeah, I also think the way it's done here is very different to the way it's done in other countries. I think, it's because like the whole trend behind it, a lot of people have just been kind of living that as like a way of life, right? You don't really think, right, this whole trend like that's behind it. You don't really, there's a lot of like shaming that goes behind, you know, the whole white version of like veganism. Sometimes it can be very intense when it's kind of, I don't know exactly the reasons behind, but I know just from like the South Asian perspective, it's done for like religious reasons and cultural reasons. So
I was actually learning a bit more about this whole idea of white veganism, because I think you're right, it seems like it's a lot more intense and there's a lot more morality like attached to it and sort of like moral superiority attached to it, which is what I sort of focused on when I was I started thinking about like the seal hunt, which I'm sure you guys have like heard before. It's something that's been like very adamantly protested by environmentalists, by vegans. And I do see a lot of value in veganism, and I do try to limit the amount of meat and dairy products that I eat, because I think that there's a lot to be critiqued when it comes to like agriculture and like mass fishing and all of that. But it totally ignores like Indigenous and Inuit perspectives a lot of the time, which I think is kind of ironic considering if you're looking for people who know the most about like eating sustainably, those are the people that probably are more knowledgeable and have like more roots in that than anyone. So that was definitely something that I saw that was like pretty frustrating to learn about when I was researching, sort of this idea of like, if you eat any meat at all, if you do like anything related to like meat or animal products, you're an evil person, when there's so much history and tradition when it comes to hunting for a lot of these Indigenous and Inuit people.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. That's like the biggest, sometimes like even when I was trying to eat clean, something I find very deterring is how intense it can be if you're trying and, you know, you're not immediately perfect right away. And you see a lot of like a lot of the recipes I was looking at, if you go on like YouTube and stuff, there's a lot, you find a lot of like white creators and influencers making like veganizing a lot of like ethnic recipes, like you see them making vegan Asian stir fry, or you see them making like, and if somebody who's grown up eating a certain type of food for a very long time, it can be hard. Like it's a different thing to adjust to, which is why I think if you had more Asian people doing those things, because there are a lot of Asians out there that are vegans, right? They just don't have the platform and nobody's, right? They don't have the voices. It would be actually really beneficial to the vegan community, right? It would really help convert more people and open more people to the idea of like eating sustainably.
And I think when you're talking about like the seal hunt, this reminded me of a Netflix documentary I recently watched. I'm sure other people may have watched as well, called Seaspiracy. And this guy, you know, it was a great movie in some aspects. So in the case that it was highlighting kind of the fishing industry, which I think a lot of people don't think twice about. I think when we think of like animal agriculture, people think of like how like chickens are cooped up in these like small little pens, or like the dairy industry and how that like affects the cows and all these things, but people don't really typically think about the fishing industry. But what I kind of like got from like looking at it was how he kind of, maybe not intentionally, but it seemed like it was demonizing kind of Asian culture and very much like seeking to highlight, oh, look at, you know, in these Asian countries, they, you know, eat like shark fins and they do this and that, where as if like Western cultures and other, you know, cultures don't consume as much, you know, seafood, which was not great. So yeah, it just goes back to like the whitewashing of these like cuisines, when like also the same Asian culture that he was kind of highlighting, I was like, these are the people who probably eat more plant-based than in Western cultures. And I think another thing that you brought up as well, like people do it for a different reason. There's a huge moralization of eating plant-based in Western culture, which isn't in other places. I can just speak from like back home and like, and like, for example, like more sub-Saharan African regions where people may eat more plant-based simply because they don't have access to meat all the time, like 24, you know, or 7 days of the week. People may not eat dairy all of the time because they can't afford to have dairy as part of their diet, but it's more attractive when it's like a choice. Like sustainable living, sustainable diet is more attractive when it's done for like, oh, I'm like, I'm rich, but I'm deciding to like do this for the animals. Whereas people, as you're saying, have been living like this for centuries because they know that they can't afford to just kill a cow every single day for their food. So yeah, I think that's a huge issue. And another thing I wanted to touch on that I didn't mention before, but like in the way that like this moralizing of this eating is done as well, sometimes it's done in a way that negatively affects and puts off people of color. The fact that it's so white-centered, they do it, you know, it's easy for, you know, white people who are vegan in it for the sake of marketing to kind of promote it in a way that's comparing it to the traumas of people of color. Like, oh, we have another, for example, this is things that I've actually seen in like the marketing of veganism was like, oh, this is a second Holocaust of the animal population. It's like, you don't have to compare these two things. These are not like comparable. You can promote veganism, plant-based, whatever, without like tokenizing the trauma of other communities. So, and I think that if there were platforms given to people of color, you wouldn't see that happening. But because it's so white-centered, there's nobody in the community kind of being like, hey, this isn't okay. You can't market it like this. So yeah, that's something I also saw.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say that's a really, really good point. And that's something, because I was born in South Asia, I grew up, and it's very normalized. No Indian restaurants. I have a lot of friends who they've been vegetarian their whole lives, right? They've never tasted chicken. It's just a cultural religious reason. So for me, it's very just normal, right? Like it's very normal. And so I have had numerous experiences here where just as Tamani was mentioning, seeing protests that are very like violent or very like off-putting because they're so aggressive, and it's kind of, yeah, it's like a little bit scary just kind of how the angle they're coming at this with from someone you've grown up and it's just normal and you're wondering why are people comparing it and taking it to extremes like this. And yes, white people didn't invent, you know, you know, animal free cruelty and like, you know, sustainable eating. And I think it just kind of ties into what we were talking about at the beginning of this episode, how it's just kind of labeling now more maybe white cuisine as being more sustainable, right? Not as cruel to animals. And that's just, it's making it harder for like people of color and our diets and our restaurants and stuff to flourish because, you know, they're getting that label. And it just kind of adds to that supremacy, right, that we were talking about in food, right, that like racism and that discrepancy that's already there.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point that's been made. Like white people have the privilege of like making their veganism glamorous because it's a choice that they have. It's like, yeah, like the healthy lifestyle that they can sort of have that moral superiority for. But yeah, I was reading an article actually about that Seaspiracy documentary. And an Inuit woman responded on TikTok basically saying like, you can't demonize the seal hunt fishing or any kind of traditional hunting when you don't know like the context behind what these Indigenous and Inuit people are actually facing. Particularly Inuit people, there's a huge food insecurity problem and there's also a huge food price problem. I think I was reading you can pay up to $70 for a vegetable tray in the Northwest Territories. So it is a huge blind spot, I think, to demonize that entire industry when not only does this have like traditional and cultural significance, but also it's just a way to actually survive. Like, I think a lot of white people are out of touch with the fact that food isn't something that everyone just has unlimited access to.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And something that like is just occurring to me now, and I know I've had conversations with a lot of like friends of mine who've grown up vegetarians their whole lives, and sometimes they found that when they go in public and they'll find that white people will come out with they'll publish like vegan cookbooks that are filled with recipes of like, you know, vegan versions of cuisine that didn't need that, right, that were already vegan, that were already vegetarian. And so now you see all these like vegan cookbooks and stuff, and I think it also just kind of highlights just how like much people don't understand or don't really care to understand our culture sometimes, right?
And I think like you brought up such a good point, Peyton, with like the affordability, and I didn't even, yeah, we don't really critically think about like the context of why certain things are happening. And I think it's always like important to critically analyze that. And $70 for a vegetable tray is ridiculous. And it's also like making me think of like food deserts and like certain parts of, I'm not sure if it happens in Canada, but I've definitely watched documentaries in like the US of how like communities of color typically don't have access to healthy foods. Like their neighborhoods are much more littered with like fast food. And that's another way that like racism like pops up within like the context of food and food systems, is that like for communities of color, it's not as easy to choose that healthy lifestyle. It's not as easy to pick a plant-based diet when all that you're given and all that you have access to is like either fast food or, you know, unhealthy, more meat-based stuff. And also like the gentrification of like a lot of these sustainable diets and things like quinoa and like brown rice, all of these are things that were already present in like non-white cultures, but now that like white people like it and it's part of like the sustainable living, it's hiked up the prices to such an extent that those communities who you know, they've been using that as part of their culture for years. Like, I didn't know, like, quinoa apparently comes from South America, but the way it's marketed and kind of seen, you'd think it was like a white people thing, but it's so overpriced that like now even those communities can't use it as much as they probably would. And that negatively affects obviously the health of communities of color as well.
Yeah, I was actually reading an article about that too, like sort of the way that certain foods that people of color have traditionally eaten for like affordable costs getting gentrified. Particularly I saw one that was, it was like collard greens, which I know has been like long eaten by like people of color, particularly Black communities, apparently was getting a huge like PR marketing turn in like Whole Foods type spaces where they were trying to make it the new kale. Like, I think that's literally what they said, like collard greens are the new kale. And it really just makes you like turn your head and be like, okay, like what's going on here? Like,
okay, so we've touched on a lot of like important issues, and obviously it's difficult to, you know, cover everything that's under this topic of racism in the food industry, but you know, these are just the topics that were more interesting to us, and I hope that for our listeners they gain something from it. And yeah, I hope you enjoy also the next segment, which is going to be interview portion.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Accessibility,
disability,
mental health,
ADHD and ADD,
and many, many more topics we explore and cover.
But where?
On CITR's All Access Pass.
A unique and collectively run show on equity, inclusion, and creating awareness for people of all abilities in BC and around the world.
Catch us every other Wednesday afternoon from 3 to 4.
If you want more info or want to get involved, please find us on Facebook or send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Hi, welcome to Intersections. My name is Randy.
And my name is Anastasia.
And we're here with Ariane Prasad. They are a documentary filmmaker, writer, and community organizer based in Toronto. They have a Master's of Fine Arts in Documentary Media from Ryerson University. Ariane has also been a restaurant service professional in Toronto for over 15 years. In March 2020, they started the TRWRF, a nonprofit offering grocery assistance and medical health care or mental health care access to restaurant workers in Toronto. So, hello, Ariane. Thank you very much for coming on our show. We're very excited to be speaking with you. So to start off, I just want to congratulate you on your podcast Behind, which is premiering Friday, at least according to your Twitter account. The podcast is the main reason that we invited you on the show, because it showcases the passion that you have for the workers in this industry. Could you give our listeners an insight into what your podcast will be talking about and also where they can find it?
Yeah, this is, I mean, first of all, it's awesome to be in company in the company of two people who are at least two who are interested in this podcast, because I have been, as you probably know from your really excellent research, it, like, you know, some of the stuff that I've done, and I've been in like the public eye or done interviews and what have you, like that kind of stuff, public facing stuff, in the past year. And all of it has been to uplift the Toronto Restaurant Workers Relief Fund, or kind of like shining light on the conditions that existed before COVID that have created the current restaurant worker or the current restaurant situation that most people are aware of. And not to go right into that, but the podcast is like my passion project, or it's something that I'm doing completely for myself and my community. And the other things that I do are, that sentiment informs everything else that I do for sure. But this is the only thing that I'm doing right now that I can say is like also filling up my cup in this way, where I'm like restored by, I started Behind as a documentary film. That was the intention. Last year, in March, when I was laid off and all of my friends were laid off and my community was in this state of a shock and also desperation, and we entered this survival mode collectively, I think, starting then, and we haven't left it since. but I, in my own despair, wanted to connect to people. And there's a really lovely collaborative aspect to behind as well that comes from the fact that I started reaching out to my friends who are restaurant workers to ask them how they were doing and dealing with, you know, just isolation and not being at a bar every single night, like whether to drink or to work. And what was that like? And so much of what I was asking people, so much of what we wanted to talk about then was about the personal, us missing our own community, us missing our friends, and sort of the specter of like financial instability and like the future of what was going to happen to our industry wasn't in the forefront of our minds. It was very much like, we are human beings, we are also isolated, our work is extremely for most of us, our work is very interpersonal and very public facing, so that was like a very quick a hard stop that happened. And so what I wanted to do was initially get people filming themselves on their phones, talking about what they're dealing with and talking about, you know, how are they, what are their coping methods. And earlier this year, when I was like, whoa, you can just use the audio, or you can just have interviews with people and use the audio and like try to get good audio. And because these stories need to be told like right now. And every time something comes up in the news or someone reaches out to me from the news specifically to say or to ask, hey, can you talk to us about what's going on with restaurant workers and why so many of them don't want to go back to work, for example? I bristle a little because I'm like, yeah, you know, I personally have been talking about a lot of these issues in the media, and many of my colleagues have, with much nuance, been talking about this stuff. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that I feel defeated sometimes as someone who is trying to like make this sort of pivot from like working as a restaurant worker to now being a restaurant worker activist, like advocacy-based community organizer, you know. It's tough when it feels like so much time has passed, everyone's lives have been drastically changed. But for restaurant workers, you know, I personally don't live in the same house. I don't have a house or an apartment of my own. I still don't have a job. My life has been drastically changed, but I haven't had any time to sort of like to look at that in an objective way, even though I've had, you know, you can say that we've had like all this time to process. So this podcast is a way for me to like share how I've been processing with my community, in a way that feels like authentic and whole and like authored, you know, by me, and like how I want to share the stories the way I want to share them, without this unnecessary like reduction of the issues to sound bites that are like, oh, tell people why they should care about restaurant workers. Like, it's not going to work because it isn't hitting. It's not going to resonate. Like, the big takeaway is the first episode will sort of be an overview of where I'm coming from and frame the podcast, like necessarily frame the podcast, you know, in light of the work that I've been doing. But the very first episode is a bit of an in-depth look at my friend Alex's life as a restaurant worker. He's also a musician. And so he talks about the struggle of you know, creating art or being an artist, and how that rubs up against restaurant worker, how that how both have been shaped by the other, and how restaurant work was necessary in terms of like acquiring money, but then what sort of thing. So it's like the big question that I'm trying to provide some answers for in this first episode is, why don't people want to go back to restaurant work, especially for ones, my friend that we'll hear from in that episode worked at some of the hottest restaurants in Toronto, had a successful career by all means, you know, looking from the outside looking in, that's what you would think. And so it's sort of like, with even in these situations where it might seem like this person is living a best case scenario, they don't want to go back. Why is that? And then further, what kind of the other feature of the first episode is how does age or growing or adulthood and adulting relate to restaurant work? Or, and I mean, generally, we can also talk about how this relates to like other careers that people seemingly age out of, or careers that are seen as transient and also adolescent or childish, juvenile. Why that framing happens, and what happens to the people that work those jobs that are legitimate adults in their 30s doing this. And so some of the more, like, I don't want it to necessarily be like, okay, this episode, like I was saying, this episode is about this topic per se, but more that you're going to take away, you're going to have some, like, something to chew on specifically as it relates to employment, labor in the restaurant world, and where do we go from here? You know, like, I don't have answers, but I definitely can share with you what my community knows has been going wrong, what we think we could do better, what we think we could do differently.
Can really tell your passion from your answer, because it sounds like there's so much contained. I mean, in this podcast, and like understanding it comes from this documentary that we saw on your website that you were working on. And it, obviously, like, it's such a big topic. Like, we, whenever we go into these episodes, we always know that, like, this is like a short intro, because like there's so much to talk about. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. We'll definitely get our listeners share where they can find it. But yeah, Anastasia, I think we'll ask a question now.
Lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, and it does actually connect to your first episode. I'm really looking forward to listening to your podcast. I feel like it's really relatable, like working the service industry. But we're going to focus, more on why people might not want to come back. And just for the listeners, you helped found the Toronto Restaurant Workers Relief Fund with Stefan Iwaskow. I don't think I'm saying that correctly. I don't know. But when the pandemic hit, this is when you founded it, and you created this fund because the pandemic forced 480,000 Ontario restaurant workers out of their jobs. And in your organization, you provide digital gift cards for groceries and therapy to restaurant workers. And since this episode is focusing on racism in the food industry, and with your experience creating this non-for-profit, and also being a part of the restaurant industry in Toronto for 15 years, would you be able to describe unique factors that affect marginalized workers while working in the service industry?
Absolutely, yeah. And the person that I started the Relief Fund with is my partner, my life partner, Stefan. And he's white, he's worked in the restaurant industry, he's cis, and he's had completely different experiences from me, but like lives knowing that the experiences that I've had as a multiply marginalized person are really what the industry is built on, unfortunately, because the exploitation of people who are already marginalized is kind of is what we're trying to change about the industry, like some of, but it is kind of foundational to how labor is extracted or whatever, right? In my first episode, I don't talk about racism overtly. For me, when I personally do my work, specifically restaurant work advocacy, I feel like my lived experience or my personhood comes through in terms of like being marginalized or having experienced these things. And it's interesting because we don't talk about that, like we don't talk about like some of the systemic issues in terms of that in the restaurant industry in the episode, but I hope that it's felt, because something, maybe I'll try to find a way to add this in the podcast episode, but my friend Alex and I worked a lot of the same jobs at the same restaurants at different times. He is also white and cis, and also had a completely different experience. And so what would happen is, we talk about this in the podcast a little bit, but what would happen is, when we both worked at a place called Bar of Hell, I was, for example, honestly was like asked to do more and paid less than he was for the exact same title. So that's like a really, that's just kind of the only way that I really touch on it. And we're going to talk about abolishing tips And what that could look like. And I think that that episode in the future, sorry, this is going to be a future episode, the tipping thing, and plus solidarity, that's going to be our entry point into having more acute rate conversations like about racism. But yeah, so my experience specifically is, I can, if I can talk about it from like being like gender fluid or non-binary, it's and like coming out post, post-restaurant worker career, it was a big moment for me because restaurant work really womanized, feminized, unnecessarily feminized me and unnecessarily made me, framed me, like my workers, my coworkers, the management that I worked with, who were all the management that I've ever worked with have all been white. I've been every place that I've worked, I've been the only person of color on management. And I have never worked in management with a non-binary person or a trans person. And so when I was living and like identifying as a woman, while working at some of these like really prestigious places, I did what marginalized people do, I think, which is like looked at it as a personal failure when it felt as though my life was, my life in the jobs that I was doing alongside my white and cis counterparts were, felt doubly hard. And it was always like, why is this so much harder for them? Why are you so burnt out kind of thing? And there is this underpinning and in the restaurant industry as well, where burning yourself out or overworking is glorified, and complaining, asking, creating boundaries or asking for space is seen as complaining or seen as weak. And when it's external, it's one thing, but when you're doing it to yourself, where you're like, I am this, I can't handle this, therefore I am weak, therefore I'm bad at this job. That was happening to me. And I realized it was because I was, I think as a Black or brown person, a person who's read by white people as Black as well, when my hair was long and I was like femme presenting, there was this expectation that I would manage the restaurant, like do the operational things of managing the restaurant, you know, whatever, all of everything that entails, while also providing this like well of emotional support to all of the other managers that didn't live the life that I lived, that, and further, that had this sort of like unfortunately common like white liberal sentiment of like, you know, I know about LGBTQ stuff. Like I'm aware, like I even had a person try to explain to me one time about like solidarity with trans folks. And it just goes to show, like you read people as cis in the world, you read people as cishet in the world, and you just don't know what you're talking about. Like, or you don't know what you're doing because you're making assumptions and you should just stop when you find yourself doing that. But I wasn't out, I was using she, her pronouns at the time. So like, that's one thing. And I'm existing with people who do think they know me well, but they are coworkers at the end of the day, you know, or they were coworkers. I didn't ask what my particular experience was, but assumed, I think personally, they assumed because I was, I'm red as brown or Black, and I am like a, you know, a non-white person, that maybe like I had less of a handle on these issues or a less of a grasp on talking about this stuff or understanding this stuff. And so I felt erased because I was like, hey, like I'm queer. And I actually like talk about being queer pretty often in this restaurant space. I don't tell you what my personal, like I like I said, I wasn't out then, I wasn't identifying as non-binary, I wasn't sharing that with people, but it was hurtful that I was, so from the same people who were seeking emotional support from me as a person who was like a Black woman in the restaurant world at the time, seen that way, those same people would then be like, okay, I'm gonna teach you how to be an ally to the LGBTQIA community, by the way. And I'm like, that really hurts because I'm now like the fact that I'm not even seen as someone who could have any sort of like theoretical or grasp on the theory of and practice of this, is that was hurtful. And the reason I'm bringing it up in this specific way is because, especially as it relates to front of house service work, to be femme and to be white is the goal. So for trans folks that might not have like present super femme, or for trans folks who want to gain what you can gain from working in this like pseudo gig economy where you can like pick up shifts, make a couple hundred dollars potentially through tips, and then, you know, go do whatever else you do, like whatever art you do or whatever it is you do, you have seemingly the time to do the rest of it. The only times I've seen trans folks be elevated or whatever, put to the front to public facing roles, and this is a few times that there are ever trans people in restaurant spaces as workers in an out capacity. It's like, it basically it's just like, you have to be trans, you have to be whatever version of queer you're living, you have to be living it for cis people, and it has to be femme. You have to be like playing up the makeup, the lipstick, the hair, whatever. And so there's a huge issue with like that still being the case. And the way that it happens is so subtle. The way that it's policed is so subtle. You know, folks are asked to like wear jewelry and wear makeup, and it's seen as professional and presentable, and like you're supposed to be doing these things if you take your job seriously. And I was coming to terms with some of these ideas, like not ideas, some of this lived experience that I was having. I was processing it through how people reacted to like my hair at the time, and like it being seen as like unkempt and unruly when it was long. And then once it was short, it was like, oh, that's a man. And it's just this, there is a specific thing that happens when it relates, as it relates to Black and brown people. Black women are like over-masculinized or like masculinized by everyone. Well, Black men, you know, white women, white men. And so all of this is just to say that if you are a Black person and presenting in a femme manner in a restaurant, you will be exploited in a really insidious, subtle way that will take, for me, has taken a long time to process and to like tease out and kind of like sit with. But it is a very tricky thing, because it's painted over as it's woke washed, you know. Okay, we put like a Black, there's a Black woman running this place, how could it not be a great place? Oh, but the person, that Black person, or that marginalized person that you think you're elevating is actually in your business doing more work, more unpaid emotional work for all of your you know, your cis staff.
Yeah, what you mentioned like at the very beginning about how like speaking from like individual like experience, that I think is really important. And I think the podcast that you reference quite a bit, that like that to me is really interesting, because I think a lot of us learn, that's how we learn about these things, and having people that want to come out and share their stories is, I think, fundamental ways we can come to understand these experiences.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
So this question is a bit more specific. Restaurant workers, I was told this when I worked as a waitress. So restaurant workers are often told that, quote, the customer is always right. So how do you see that this phrase and the mentality that is connected to it contributes to the objectification and racism directed at marginalized workers?
Yeah, oh gosh, that's a great one. So the customer is always right is definitely like that phrase was sort of codified in this book called Setting the Table by Danny Meyer, who is like kind of like at the fore, well, used to be held in high regard as one of these, you know, restaurant operators that has like a very successful business based on basically pleasing customers, like basically teaching the staff that the customers always right. And I talk about this in the podcast episode very briefly because my partner, Stefan, was given this book, Setting the Table, at one of his jobs and was told to read it to be like a really good front of house person. And yeah, so there's been a lot of pushback since then. Lots of people within the industry who are outspoken about restaurant workers' rights have talked about how, you know, Danny Meyer was like a no-tipping icon for a bit, and but then like took it back and said that it wasn't working, and regardless, anyway, he just, I think, like kind of set the bar for us internally where it was like, oh, so we're supposed to be doing that. We are supposed to be putting ourselves second and putting the guests first. Okay. And so that became like very much like, if you, I think if you struggle with this thing that I brought up briefly, that I talk about in the first podcast episode, if you're trying to grow up and like adult, you know, and you're working in a restaurant and you're working in front of house and you don't get the clout that comes with being, I chef life, you know, and you want to like legitimize your work, you go to the wine world. If you don't want to go to the wine world, then you have to somehow make serving, quote unquote, like the guest experience now this, like, you know, the thing that they write books about and that you have to now read about. So as it relates to racism and people that are working in those positions, bringing the food to people and the drinks and stuff, as I was saying, like, there is a push to get white passing white or white people and cis passing or cis people, specifically women, to be in these positions because the clientele, for the most part, in Toronto, in higher end restaurants, or the regular clientele that can afford to eat out every single day or every weekend, is mostly white and mostly wealthy and doesn't really like to be told no. But in other scenarios, they'll accept the no from the bank teller or from whoever else. But when it comes to restaurant workers, they won't, because there's already, it's a space that's already treated like a power, a place where you play with power and where you flex your power. And so if you are visibly a minority or visibly don't kind of line up with the people that you're serving, it's a struggle, because like I was saying about my experience personally, I did kind of turn a lot of like the crap that I got from people inward and saw it as like failure on my own part, and saw it as like, oh, you're not passing enough. Like you're not actually like passing enough. And I think that the slight move that we've seen, and like what I was saying about like woke washing, is like, I've seen in Toronto restaurants, like one or two black people or one or two brown people, but hey, I think a lot of us know each other at like the trending restaurants, the ones that list the Blogtio or Toronto Life or whatever is going to write about. Those are the places where the majority of people that work there are white, because the majority of the people that go there are white. There's tons of restaurants in Toronto that are corporate that have lots of black and brown people working there and maybe more black and brown guests. But I think the dining public is, heavily white. And so there's this false sense now that, oh, sick, there's diversity here at this restaurant. The sommelier is black, cool. And you see that and you feel, maybe as a guest who isn't like, you know, a horrible person that wants to play with power because you're eating out, you see that and you're like, oh, I'm going to come to this place again because like this feels good to me, you know, but you don't want to, or you don't have the length and breadth to just to see what else is happening and to see that this person could actually just be tokenized and not actually given any agency and not actually being paid equal to their white counterparts, which is a big, hard, like, truth that early on last year when I started unearthing like what has happened to me and what's happened to other people, the disparity in pay between Black people, Black and brown folks and white folks, like that do the same management jobs or the same leadership roles. It's horrible. And it's not talked about because, you know, you're not supposed to talk about salary, even though you're a worker that's about to trade your labor for the money. It's like, you're not supposed to talk about it. That's tacky. That's gauche. You don't do that. So anyway, but yeah, there's this false sense right now, I think, that if you go out to eat at bar X and there's three or four servers of color, like you should be paying attention to like who is actually being represented here and like how it is sort of like a microcosm for what is happening in the world, the larger world, which is, you know, you see tons of ads now. I personally see tons of ads on my Instagram with Black and brown hands in them, and like restaurants have been known to do this, to use the one or two people that are there for representation for the so yeah, you see that, sure, Squarespace or whatever, these are the ads I'm getting, shoe companies or whatever, like are like showing you, and you, for me personally, as a marginalized person, I see it as an affront. It feels weird, and I'm like, I know that like if I go into that store right now, I would stand out in a weird way or something like that. So I guess I'm trying to warn people against feeling comfortable when they go into a spot and they're like, oh great, this place is probably good because they hire people of color, or there's some visibly queer folks here. Sick. Okay. But it's sometimes it is a lot of the same. It is very much like they're playing the game back right back at us, you know, kind of thing. So it's tricky because you're when you want to keep yourself safe as a marginalized person, safety is always an issue. It's always something that you have to be you have to take, are you safe in any situation? Like how is your being, you know, being Black, being brown, being darker skin, having different hair textures or and looking visibly queer, how is that going to make me not safe right now? When the more common way that this is kind of talked about, I think, is the sexual harassment that women specifically face in the industry. But I personally have been a part of like trying to get like trans and non-binary folks to feel comfortable talking about what they've experienced, but you probably are not surprised that they don't really want to, right? So again, it becomes the gender issue comes up again, where we can handle talking about it from a woman's perspective, from a woman's issue, but we can't even change our framing to talk about it as gender-based, because there is so little trans and non-binary representation in the restaurant world. And even as that it's increasing, it's still, it's still, for people's safety, they will still have to hide. And so instead of saying, I don't feel comfortable or safe, or I don't feel like I can live my true self working in this restaurant, but the person that's white that's working with me is able to do that, no problem. And they can like make more money than me also. Wow, how unfortunate. I'm being tipped less because of my skin color, because I look too queer, you know? So this pause for folks like that who have just experienced hurt day in and day out and have been literally traumatized by their work, for them to be like, no, thank you. I will actually not do this anymore. Maybe I'll go work in a ghost kitchen. Maybe I'll go do something that I don't have to interact with guests.
Yeah, thank you for all your answers. I feel like you really covered most of what we were interested in. And I think our listeners will be really interested in knowing more about it, because I am, and more just like a more cat, I'm just like, and listening to your conversations. So I think we'll end our episode, and I'm really grateful that you made time to talk to us. And it would, if you could let our listeners know where they can find your podcast and where they can find your other things as well, that'd be great.
So my website, www.ariannepersaud.com, is where my podcast and other work lives. And yeah, the podcast is called Behind. It will, fingers crossed, be released on Friday, June 11th at some point in the evening. And then after that, it will be a monthly. My social media is all the same, actually. Yeah, it's Irregular, just at Irregular for Instagram, Twitter, Arigular. That's my, those are all my my handles.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, thank you again for coming on our show.
This episode of Intersections is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.